Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Rocky Deer of Atlas Legal Research in Dallas. Welcome to the show, Rocky.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me.
We're pleased to have you here, and we're looking forward to our conversation. It's going to be an interesting one, I think. So
don't get your hopes up too high now, Todd. come on, let's not sell something we can't deliver on, but we'll try.
Yeah, I mean, he's giving me a hard time before we even launch into the show. That's
awesome. It's what I do.
So before we commence to the teasing too much, Rocky, let's tell our guests, let them know, those of whom are not familiar with you, tell us about your background, kind of where you came from, and maybe your legal education, because you are a lawyer. I want to make clear.
I have to make that clear to some people. They don't believe it at first. They're like, wait, what? Like, you graduated kindergarten? What is wrong with schools in America? No, I get it. So no, I appreciate you guys having me on here today. I love appellate lawyers because they're like the brain surgeons of the law. And so I always have to okay, I got to sit up. I got to make sure I've got my syntax correct because you guys are awesome at all that. So I feel honored to be a part of this august assembly. And I used the word august. I had to look that up ahead of time. And I looked up synonyms and I was like, okay, we're ready to go. But my name is Rocky Deer. I graduated law school in 1999. And it's funny, I used to be one of the younger lawyers. When I said 99, I'd be like, oh, wow. And now I'm like an old fogey. That's like last century. It's crazy. But I graduated from the University of Michigan Law School in 1999. And I grew up in the Texas area. I've been here since I was 10. I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth. For anybody out there who's from Arlington, Texas, I went to Martin High School in Arlington. Go Warriors.
Sure. And My wife's alma mater.
Yeah, I live in Fort Worth, so.
Oh, Fort Worth's my jam. Like all the Dallas people, they always think, oh, Fort Worth. And they kind of go, they brush it off. But Fort Worth is where it's at, man. It's like Fort Worth is an awesome city. And I want more people to know about it. So I grew up in Arlington. I was actually born in India. And we took a long path to finally become Texans. But it took us 10 years. We made it here after living in various places in the United States. And then graduated high school, went to undergrad at the University of Chicago, and then from there went to law school at the University of Michigan, and then got out of Michigan. I'm talking like it was an institution, like it was prison, but I got out and they paroled me, and I went to clerk for the Honorable Jerry Buckmeyer in Dallas. And then after that, I started Atlas, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first-of-its-kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. I've known you for many years. People should know. So there's a certain level of familiarity and comfort here. And that, I think, is one reason why Rocky feels so comfortable teasing me in front of all of our audience. And that's fine. I can take it.
Yeah, but I know you can.
I had noticed in doing a little preparation for the show today that you had gone to school up there in the northern parts of the country. And I found myself asking how you wound up getting to Texas. So you grew up here, but you went up north to go to college and law school.
That's right.
So having been in Texas since you were 10, you said you moved around the country a little bit, but was that a cultural shock having gone from the culture in the great state of Texas and Tarrant County in the city of Arlington to winter coats and all the things you have to do to prepare yourself for the weather up there?
I'll tell you, 7 years was enough of doing that. And then I was glad to come back. I was like, okay, I'll go as deep in the heart of Texas as I have to just to get away from that. And I'm not saying that to in any way denigrate the Midwest. I mean, it's a great place. So when you moved here, the first place we lived in, when you first came to the United States, I was a baby. It was Rapid City, South Dakota. And that's actually where my earliest memories are, believe it or not. So everybody thinks it's just Mount Rushmore, but for us, it was home. That's where we lived. Those are some interesting kind of first memories to have. And then from there, we went to Denver, Colorado, lived there for a time, and then lived in Orlando, Florida for a year, and then made our way to Texas. So I'd been accustomed to the cold, but there's cold and then there's Chicago, and it's two very different things, right? And I remember my second year of college, it was 93 to 94. That winter was to date the coldest winter in 150 years. Like no exaggerations.
Wow.
I remember being outside and the wind chill was minus 80. So It didn't matter how much thinsulate you had on. I mean, you were going to be numb walking in. I mean, it was like losing an oral argument. Hey, appellate law reference. And, you know, it was just one of those, you walk out and you go, you know, what in the hell did I get myself into? I remember I was outside at one point, I was writing something down and the ink in my pen froze. That's how cold it was. So yeah, did that for a time. And it taught me that I love Chicago. It's a great city when the weather's nice. People in Chicago know how to party when the weather's good because they're so used to being cooped up for 9 months cold and rain and all this. When it gets nice, they are ready to party down and hit it. And then Michigan was a wonderful place, but I was in Ann Arbor. I mean, it wasn't exactly the real Michigan. And so I don't know that I can say I walked away really knowing what Michigan is like, but Ann Arbor was lovely and a great place. But yeah, after three winters there, I was like, we're in Texas, we're staying. I'm going anywhere.
I do have to defend Michigan a little bit. I have a family connection there, but there are a few places that are better to be than Ann Arbor in the summer, especially compared to Texas.
And yet, like an idiot, I left during the summers and came back, you know, came back here or went to clerk somewhere. So yeah, I never quite got to enjoy the Ann Arbor summers. I may have to change that.
Hmm. Well, you did come back to Texas and you mentioned your job with Judge Buckmeyer, who, for those of us that have been practicing law since the last century and maybe a little longer, right, is certainly a familiar name to us. And most notably for a lot of folks, for his humor column in the Texas Bar Journal that ran for many, many years and is now being continued on by his daughter, I believe.
So yes.
It's a staple. So tell us about how you got going with Judge Buckmeyer and what your experience was like in your clerkship.
Okay. Like everything with Judge Buckmeyer, this was a non-traditional story. Okay. This wasn't the typical, hey, here's my resume. I'm hoity-toity. So, you know, hire me to be your law clerk. I often say, and he would have admitted to it if he was here to testify on the record, he hired me despite my academic record, not because of it. So the way it happened actually was first year of law school. A lot of folks who go to school in Texas may not realize how this is, but when you're a 1L and you're outside of Texas and you apply to Texas firms to be a law clerk after your 1L summer, they don't want to touch you. They're like, okay, we don't know if this kid's going to stay up north. Is he going to go to one of the coasts? Is he actually going to come back to Texas? Is he just coming here to party and make some money off of us? So they're understandably skeptical, or at least they were back in those days. And so I couldn't find a job to save my life. I mean, I just thought, wow, I just suck in all ways that you can possibly suck. I mean, what's going on with me? So it was actually a third year. It was a 3L who saw me despondently walking around campus one day. And he said, look, get your act together. He said, why don't you intern for a federal judge in your area? Okay. This was February of 1997. And so I said, okay, sure. And in those days, the internet was in its very nascent phases. You couldn't just Google the name of somebody and find it. I actually went and found a directory. It was these things that they had these hard covers and it had these little pieces of paper inside it. It's called a book. And it was a directory. And so I looked up all the federal judges in this area, Fort Worth, Dallas, and just applied to all of them. I called up the chambers. Do you guys take summer interns? The first name on there was Jerry Buckmeyer. He was the chief judge of the Northern District of Texas at that time. And his chambers is one of the law clerks who picked up. And I remember very distinctly, she said, well, we don't interview for those until April. I said, well, I'm going to be in town next week for spring break. I mean, I'll come any time of day. I'll bring you guys donuts. I don't care. I'd love to meet with you guys. And so she said, okay, send me your resume. So I did this thing called faxing. I faxed the resume over to her. And for those of you who don't know what faxing is, you can probably find videos of it on YouTube. But anyway, so I faxed my resume over, and an hour and a half later, I get a call and they said, we'd love to see you next week. And I'm thinking, okay, finally, somebody realizes how brilliant I am. You know, it took a judge to realize, and that makes sense. These people are educated. They've been selected by the president and ratified by the Senate. No wonder he realizes how smart I am. So I come in the next week on Wednesday. It was spring break here, and walk in, and the clerks, they're all very gracious, sit me down. But the second question they ask me, they say, on your resume, and this is absolutely true, in the interest section, it said celebrity impersonations, because I could do celebrity impersonation. They said, which ones can you do? They had me do Bill Clinton. Ross Perot was still in the news back then. So I did a Ross Perot. I did Kermit the Frog. I had these voices I did. They took a sampling of them. Then they went and said, we'll be right back. And they went within like 3 minutes later, they take me into the judge's office and he sits me down and goes, said, so where are you from? Oh, this is great. It's a pleasure to meet you. What do you enjoy about law school? He was a very gracious man. And so he wouldn't just launch into what he really wanted to know, which was finally goes, I heard you can do impersonations. And that's how it started. So he said, we're about to go to lunch. And he took me to lunch with his chambers and actually somebody who was applying for a judicial clerkship. She was interviewing for a clerkship that day. So there's two interviews going on at the same time. It took her a moment to realize I was not her competition. I was interviewing for an internship. But we go to lunch and he said, when I give you the signal, I want you to do an impersonation. But he never gave me the signal. So we come back to chambers and then he has everybody come together, other judges. He gathers them all in his chambers and says, this is Rocky. He's going to do an impersonation. I think he had me do Bill Clinton or Kermit the Frog or something. And I did it. And then he's like, you're hired. And that's how I got the job to be his intern. And then at the end of the internship that summer, he said, well, if you want to come back, we'd love to have you. So that's how I got the clerkship. He never saw my grades. Thank God.
So which one of the impersonations are you going to do for us now?
Do people still remember Bill Clinton? Does anybody?
We have to hear it. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Come on. We're going to put you on the spot, Rocky.
That's fine. This happens all the time. I always get put on the spot because I have a child. All right. Bill Clinton, back in those days, he'd have been like, I got to tell you, Judge, you got to be real careful because interns can get you in trouble. Trust me, I know how this works. Now, if you're not going to pay him anything, you got to be sure he's not going to go out and squeal on anybody. I can talk to you off the record. Please don't swear me to anything. And I mean,
all right.
Kermit the Frog would have said, I've tried to warn Bill Clinton about flies, but he doesn't seem to listen. It's a whole thing we could get into.
Is it still on your resume? I have to know that. I didn't see it in your bio online.
I don't think it's on LinkedIn. I may have to add that in.
I think you absolutely need to.
We need to put that somewhere on. I don't think LinkedIn has a mechanism for that, but maybe I can figure out a way.
Well, that certainly is a non-traditional path, which is something we've covered a lot here on the show. Is we certainly doing what we do. I mean, clerkships are a very common thing, and internships with not only appellate judges, but state trial judges, as was Jody's experience. Mm-hmm. So we're certainly encouraging, and I admire your gumption, and you managed to turn your talent for impressions into your first real job out of law school. So not everybody can say that.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody's as shameless as I am. Some people actually have a sense of decency and decorum. I lack those qualities, but actually, and Jody, I'm curious, which judge did you intern with?
Judge John Woldridge in Houston. He was a state district judge.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome.
So was that a 1 year or 2 year clerkship with Judge Buckmeyer then?
That was a 1 year. It was 1 year and I wish it could have gone on forever. It was honestly, it was the best experience I could have ever asked for. He was an absolutely amazing person to work with. And all the joking aside, I learned a lot about leadership from Judge Buckmeyer. He was one of these people that as a law clerk, I didn't realize the value of it at the time. I never really had a real job, so to speak. Growing up, my parents owned a printing business. So I would work at the printing business when I was on breaks, right? So it wasn't like I went out and worked at a grocery store or waited tables. I was working at the family business. So this is my first time really working outside of that environment. And I didn't realize what I was learning. I realized I was learning about the law, but I didn't realize what I was learning about how to be a boss. And Judge Buckmeyer, what he would do with us law clerks is he entrusted us. As lawyers, it's very easy for us to be control freaks, right? Most of us are. There's a way we like to do things. We like our sentences structured a certain way. We want our emails drafted a certain way. And so we feel like we have to do everything ourselves. Judge Buckmeyer would get a new set of law clerks every year, and he trusted each and every single one of them to do their jobs. So we would draft his opinions. He would read them over. He would make changes where necessary. Some judges will tell their law clerks, just give me the research or give me a draft, but I'm going to go back and retype everything. That was very rare with Judge Buckmeyer. There were times when we would differ with him. There'd be a difference of opinion. We would discuss it. He was never saying, you know, look, I'm the judge. Here's how it's going to be. He would talk to us about it. It was a collaborative process where we kind of arrived at what the right decision was. The other thing that I really admired about working with him, and this is more what I learned about being a lawyer and how I think the law should be, which is he said, never rely on the briefing from the parties. Read the briefs, cite check them, but never just rely on one side's brief. Always go back, research the law on your own from scratch. Don't start with what they cited. Do your own research and see what the right answer is. And so whenever we would draft an opinion, we were always very confident that whether we're reversed or affirmed on appeal, we were convinced that we got the right result at that time based on what we knew. So it was a one-year clerkship, but I think if I'd stuck with it even till now, I'd still be learning new things from it.
Right. Well, you finished up your year, and what was next for you? You stayed in the Dallas area, clearly. What did you wind up doing after that?
I started Atlas Legal Research right after that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, I did not assume that you went straight into starting your company, but you're that rare animal that goes straight from law school to a clerkship to starting your entrepreneurial venture, which is still going today. So that's awesome.
Well, the real reason I went straight into it, one had to do with Judge Buckmeyer himself, and the other one had to do more with me. The Buckmeyer part. So what Atlas does effectively is we write legal briefs for lawyers all across the country. We write their legal briefs, we'll summarize depositions, we'll help them summarize and understand medical chronologies. In short, we help lawyers with everything outside the courtroom. So even if they're in trial, if they have to respond to a motion in limine, or they need to file one, or they need a trial brief or whatever, we'll help them with those things. If they're on appeal, we'll draft appellate briefs for them. But effectively, we're doing all this work outside of the courtroom. Now, companies like Atlas, we're not, I wouldn't say ubiquitous. Again, another word I had to look up in preparation to talk to two appellate lawyers, but it's becoming less uncommon than it was 23 years ago. But when I started the company, this was very rare. I think there may have been one or two other companies that were doing something similar. And when I talked to Judge Buckmeyer about the idea, he was all for it. He said, two thumbs up, go do it. We need more of this in the law. And so he encouraged me to just go out and start it. And he said, look, do it right away, because he said, the legal jobs will be waiting for you if this doesn't work, but do it now. So he kind of gave me that blessing, if you will. And the other part of it too, was that I know myself, and I tend to get trapped in inertia, where if I was at a firm, I would have probably gotten there. I'd have made friends. I'd have liked the money, and I would have gotten comfortable. And at some point I thought, oh, well, maybe I could make partner. And then next thing you know, 10 years go by and I'm still at the firm. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. There are folks who have made their careers sometimes at a single firm the entire time. I think that's wonderful. It's just not what I wanted. And I knew that I would end up never starting this if I had gone that route. So I just went straight into it. I think I had $5,000 saved up from my clerkship salary. just said, okay, let's throw caution to the wind and see what happens.
That's really interesting to hear that part of your story, because I mean, the whole time I've known you, it's been head of Atlas. And to kind of take a step back from that before we move forward.
Sure.
One of the things that I have known you for, and I think you are generally known for in the legal community, is someone who has an interest in adaptation and legal innovation. And I mean, you're kind of exhibit A for this, right? Because you just went through how nothing like Atlas was being done at the time and how Judge Buckmeyer encouraged you to do it. So aside from just taking the judge's advice and thinking, I'm going to do this while I'm young, which certainly I think is good advice if you can do it. Did you always know that you wanted to do something entrepreneurial like that? Or what really led you down that path?
I think I did. I mean, I grew up in a business family. My parents ran this small printing business that my mom still runs to this day out in Irving, Texas. And so business was just part of what I knew growing up. My dad used to be a structural engineer back when he first came to the United States, up until about 1986. And in 86, the Texas oil market just bottomed out. There were massive layoffs everywhere. And being a structural engineer, that meant a lot of the projects that his company was working on just went belly up. So he lost his job. And for us, that was a big turning point as a family that, okay, he was doing good work. He was rising through the ranks. And then one day, they just say, okay, it's over. And there he was. We just moved here maybe 10 months earlier. And he has two kids. He's trying to make a go of it. And it's like everything just fell out from underneath him. And it was during that time that he and my mom decided, and actually I was part of the conversation as well. We decided we're going to go into business for ourselves. We're not going to let this happen again. And I'm glad we did. I mean, it led to a whole different path for us. So I think for me, that was just part of the psychology going into why I'd start something on my own. In terms of my personality or just kind of who I am, I can conform if I need to, but I don't really like it. It's like be at the office by a certain point.
Yeah.
Wear clothes that look like this and jeans on Friday or whatever. That just wasn't me. I can do it, but I like doing things kind of my own way. And starting my own thing meant that if I was up late working and I needed to sleep in and start working at noon, I could do that. If I wanted to work all weekend, I could do that too. There was nothing really constraining me. And so I think it was just always something that was in my blood. And I just said, okay, I'm going to do it. Now I will say that from the outside looking in, it can sound like a very incredible story. Oh, this guy is so enterprising. He went out and started his own business. There's another side to it, which is I had a lot of familial support. My parents were there. They lived in the DFW area. When I was starting this business, I lived at home. When people talk about, oh, so-and-so lives at home with his or her parents, I say, don't look down on that. You don't know why they're doing that. There may be something that they're working towards, and that's why they're living at home with their parents. I lived at home with my parents. I mean, I remember being 26 years old and I was still in the room I grew up in, but it was a way to save on rent and be able to just focus. Laundry and cooking and all that stuff was done. I could just focus on my business, and kind of hats off to my mom and dad for giving me that level of support.
Absolutely.
So the story would not have happened without them.
No, that's a great story. And gosh, I'm just trying to imagine young Rocky coming out of that clerkship.
Kind of hard the way I look now, isn't it?
Don't use my words against me, Rocky. No, I'm trying to imagine. I mean, you're at this crossroads where you can either, maybe you can go into a law firm. I'm sure Judge Buckmeyer would have been glad to give you a recommendation to go in and practice commercial litigation or anything really at a firm in Dallas where it's a very strong legal market. And I have no doubt you could have become employed in a traditional law firm right then, just based on the judge's recommendation. But not only did you say, no, I'm going to do something different. A lot of people these days, I think the something different they would do would be maybe to start their own law practice, mm-hmm. which you could have done that too, but you even chose yet another path from that to create this business that now, I mean, you've been going, as you say, for 23 years or something like that.
It's weird to say it out loud, but yeah, 23 years.
Yeah. And to fill a niche that at the time, as you pointed out, I don't remember anything like that being available. I mean, the closest thing that law firms had available to them, I think, would be to hire law students to work in the summer or during the regular part of the year as sort of freelancers. But It was quite, I would say, innovative. And I'm curious, you've been doing it for so long now, I would bet that you've seen a lot of ebb and flow and change over the course of the last 23 years, just in your business. I want to drill down some more on the business and what kind of services you offer. You say it was everything outside the courtroom. So, you know, full on support work for lawyers, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
I guess let me start by asking, how did you get your first clients?
Oh, wow. Okay. And actually, I have to correct myself. It's 22 years, 23 since I graduated law school, but really started this in 2000. So that would be, we're going on 22 years this year. So the crazy thing was, and I'm going to get to your question in a second, but I'll tell you kind of how this, it kind of relates back, right? When I started the company, lawyers were understandably skeptical about handing off something as important as a legal brief or research on a key issue to just some dude that they meet somewhere, right? And to make things even stranger, I was sending this work to India. So I'd opened up an office in India and I was outsourcing high-end legal work to India. Now, we were not the first company to outsource legal work to India. There were other folks doing that, but we were the first ones to do really high-end work, things like legal briefs and appellate briefs going out to India. And so folks were understandably skeptical of the concept, but they also liked the idea that there was a time zone difference, so work could get done faster. They liked the idea of lower costs. And there was a whole reason why I came up with this rubric back in that time. We can talk about that if you guys want. But the way I got my first client was actually, interestingly, like all things, especially in the early part of my career, it kind of goes back to Judge Buckmeyer yet again. So Judge Buckmeyer was very involved in this group called Bar None. And Bar None, I think, so Austin has the Austin Bar and Grill. I think Houston has their own version of this. It's a Lawyer's Follies program that Bar None would put on every year. It would take place at SMU in the Greer Garson Theater. And it was just a group of lawyers, paralegals, legal spouses, all getting together to put on a series of funny shows and skits and songs that were all kind of parodying the law and current events. Judge Buckmeyer was one of the founding members of Bar None. And every year he would find one or more of his law clerks and he would say, hey, I'd really love it if you go do Bar None. And this might come as a huge shock, but he chose me the year of my clerkship. I came into work from lunch one day and there was this flyer for Bar None tryouts sitting on my chair with the name Rocky just written on top in his handwriting. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm trying out for this. And so I did Bar None that year. And then I went back for, I did like five shows total, but I did it the first year. And the woman who is, and she still is, the executive director of Bar None, the one who runs it, her name is Martha Hardwick Hoffmeister. And she and her husband, Kent Hoffmeister, are just, they're powerhouses, not just in the legal field, but they're just an amazing couple. And I did Bar None that first year. And later that year, this would have been the year 2000, I get an email from them saying, would you be interested in joining the Mac Taylor Inn of Court? Mm. And so I said, sure. So Martha and Kent, they sponsor me and get me into this Inn of Court. I had no idea what it was, but I thought, okay, it's something they're offering me. I'm going to say yes. That's something I learned early on was, when it comes to opportunities to join something with people that you admire, you always say yes. And so I said, sure, I'll do it. Went in there and at my first Inn of Court meeting, I got up, introduced myself, told him who I was as a new member. And immediately, his name is Al Silva. He's a lawyer here in Dallas. He came up and said, write your name and number down on this piece of paper. I've got somebody who could use your services. And the next day, I got a phone call and that was the first client. She is now a family court judge. It was a one-off. She never needed us again, but it was the very first time. And then my first repeat client came from the Inn of Court as well. So it all came from the Inn of Court, which came from Martha and Kent, which happened because of Buckmeyer. So it kind of all relates back through the chain. This is proximate causation.
Well, it just goes to show you that you just never know where your next case is coming from. Mm-hmm. As really we don't. Say that as lawyers, and you don't know what relationships are going to bear fruit in other ways, just beside you enjoying the person's company. And as a member of the Calvert Inn of Court here in Austin, I can tell you that it's a great organization for many reasons, but there's absolutely, there's a business element to it just because you get to know people who do various kinds of things in law practice. Mm-hmm. And so it's another great networking tool for lawyers to get connected and understand what others do to take care of their clients in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
Tell us just quickly kind of how the business built. You were outsourcing work to India. You were taking advantage of your crew doing work while the rest of us were sleeping and being able to turn around memos and projects really quickly for that reason, I would imagine. Sort of what was the overall arc of the company from then to now?
Well, I wish I could tell you it was just onward and upward and we never looked back, but business undulates. I mean, it has these ups and downs and we certainly had that. We were slowly building a cadre of legal research clients who would use us for those types of matters. And then around 2006, we were approached by a law firm, not in Texas, they were out of state. They wanted us to do document review and document indexing. Now, in those days, you didn't have computers doing it. People would literally go through each document and determine whether it was relevant or irrelevant and for what issue. And they wanted us to do that on a massive scale for this really large case. So we scaled up our office in India and started doing that work. And then about 3 months into it, the case settled. And so we had this huge infrastructure that we'd built up and the whole thing was just kind of was for naught. And so we started to get more of that kind of work, but it never quite was up to that level again. And so The business did suffer for a while, starting around late 2006. We had our ups and downs and it was a struggle to kind of keep things going. But I would say around 2010, so about a 4-year period, we're hanging on by our nails, literally. But around 2010, we got approached, and I can't say the name, but I can tell you it's a major international insurance carrier. They do a lot of commercial liability work. And they approached us to help their staff counsel offices. And for those who are unfamiliar, staff counsel is where insurance companies, especially larger ones, they'll have lawyers that work for them, but they're deployed all over the country with licenses in their respective jurisdictions, but they will handle work only for the insureds of that particular company, or that particular insurance company. So if the three of us were in a staff counsel operation, it would say the law firm of Smith, Sanders, and Deere. And then it would have a little asterisk and it would say, not a partnership. The lawyers are employees of XYZ insurance company. This particular insurance company wanted us to do this on a nationwide basis for all of their staff counsel offices. And so to really make that scale, we closed our India office and brought everything back to the United States. And so we don't do anything in India anymore. It's all here in the US. And we do primarily legal research and briefing, very little bit of the document review. But that changed our business in a major way. So we went from working mostly with smaller law firms to now working with, they're still small law offices, but they're part of a larger umbrella. And now we're working with about 3 of these big insurance companies. And that's become our sort of our primary avenue of work. Every once in a while, we still get plaintiff's case or we get smaller law firms. And those are always fun because you never know what they're going to come at you with. But a lot of our work now is the bulk of it is insurance defense.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea that you had made that transition. I remember well the days of you were working with folks, your team in India a lot. And, you know, just logically, you can see the attraction of that model for all the reasons you already covered. You were able to get good quality work at perhaps a decreased cost and on a different timetable. And so there's a lot of appeal to that, I would imagine. But no, that's interesting that you've changed the business model now. And yet you're still providing the same basic services, I guess, to those staff counsel offices. You're sort of I wouldn't say you're the back office really, but you're the legal brain behind some of those staff counsel firms, I would imagine.
I think the way they see us, at least from what they've described, is they see us as sort of the first to maybe 60 associates that you would have at a law firm, depending on the type of matter and what they need done. the first year associate matter would be something like, hey, we need a memo on this issue that we can't seem to figure an answer for. But then sometimes they'll come to us with complex issues and they want us to start helping them from the very start. And we're getting them up to a point where it gets to summary judgment and possibly to an appeal if that summary judgment ruling gets appealed one way or the other. And it's funny because one thing I've looked back on, and so you were saying a second ago that I made these transitions. And if I'm being really honest about it, I didn't make the transitions. The transitions kind of made themselves, because opportunities come and you have to see, okay, how do you adapt to this and how do you change? I loved having an indie office. It was so much fun. I'd go out there twice a year, get to hang out with all the folks there and just live a different life for a few weeks every year. But there came a point at which the loaded cost of doing business there versus doing business here was almost the same. And so it was no longer this advantageous thing to have an indie office. And this business with the staff council operations kind of forced me to sit down and really do the calculations. And I said, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense anymore. Just keep this there. Our business is changing and the needs of the business are changing. And with that, it means that we've got to reevaluate everything. It was very hard to tell the folks there that we're shutting this down. They understood. They could see the writing on the wall. And we tried very hard to give them several months' notice. Everybody was employed gainfully at good places before they left. We didn't leave anybody unemployed. And so I'm very happy that we took that step. We didn't burn any bridges, but it was a difficult decision. But sure, Sometimes you have to make those when you're doing these things.
Well, the way that you described the way the company is fitting in with its clients now, I think we found our segue into appellate practice, because you talk about a lot of things that appellate lawyers do. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool, I would say. And it's good for you and good for the companies you work with, I think, to have that kind of support. I was curious about like your take on some things that maybe that are seen and as innovations in the law today. I mean, you certainly have played your role in legal innovation. So you're at this point now in the life of the business and still thinking about legal innovation. What do you see as kind of being the trends in legal innovation today, just from your observation?
It's a big question, because there's so much going on in the law, not just in terms of law practice, but also in terms of the business of law. There's sort of two aspects to that. And law practice it's what we do. It's how we deliver justice, legal services to our clients. But then we also have to have a roof over the building. We have to be able to make payroll, all those things. And that becomes the business of law. In terms of law practice, I think there's going to be this, some people have already talked about it and some people are already working on it, but I think artificial intelligence is going to play an increasingly prominent role. Whether and to what extent, there are those who think that AI is eventually going to just take over everything, including the practice of law. For that to happen, I think you'd have to have judicial decisions also rendered by AI, which means effectively artificial intelligence is going to be the judge. For as long as you have any human interaction with the law, you will need to have some human element to the practice of law, in my view. Because at the end of the day, as lawyers, if you're asking the AI to argue what the law is, I wouldn't know how to program the computer to do it. But conceptually, it's not a huge leap to say, okay, let's go read the cases and the statutes. Here's what the law says, and present that to a jurist. But if you're trying to advocate for a change in the law, or if you're trying to talk about an area that the law may not be as vocal on, where there's maybe a dearth of case law on a particular question, that's where the human element comes in. Figuring out what's the right answer. What is the moral answer? What, from a policy perspective, do I as a judge, assuming I was a judge in this case, but what policy do I as a judge think would be best advocated by a particular decision? So I think that ultimately is going to be where AI runs into a bit of a challenge. Now, if we replace all of our judges with artificial intelligence, now theoretically you can, I don't know if it would be a justiciable system, I don't know how fair it would be, but you could have a working system where everything is controlled by AI. But I do think as we move forward, AI is going to make our jobs as lawyers both easier and harder. it's going to make it easier in that there are certain things that the AI will be able to do that we used to do. Okay. So for example, document review, it's already being done by AI. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But what it also means is that we as lawyers have to be even better when it comes to the analysis, the analytical component of what we do, because sorting out the documents themselves is no longer part of our day-to-day work. But knowing what those documents mean, figuring out where they fall in, and being able to make that argument to a judge or to a jury, we have to be on our A-plus game to really make that come home. So I think AI is where we're going to see a lot more innovation in the future. When it comes to the business of law, I think there's a lot of directions we can go in. Most immediately, I think a lot of this is going to come down to cybersecurity. Sean Tuma, who is up here in Dallas, Todd, I know you and I have both known him for many years. He was at the forefront of this. Even back in like 2010, he was sounding the alarm about cybersecurity and how to protect our data. And while we were all listening, I don't think most of us understood what he meant. He was kind of talking at least over my head. But it turns out time has proven Sean correct. And so I give a big shout out to Sean Tuma for sounding the alarm. Cybersecurity is going to be big for us as lawyers, not just as a practice area, but also in terms of protecting our offices and our clients and their data. It's something that a lot of lawyers, they don't feel well equipped to do, but we're going to have to learn. So those are the two big areas. And if we had hours and hours, I could go into others. But if I had to pick two, that would be it.
I think we may have to have you back for another episode to sort of do Law Futurist podcast. Yeah, this is all fascinating stuff. Let's transition a little bit to the State Bar of Texas podcast, because we do want to talk about that. You are the host of the State Bar of Texas podcast. Can you kind of tell us about how that got started and how you found yourself doing that?
Sure. And when you say I'm the host, let's make it very clear. I don't want that to in any way denigrate the State Bar and reflect poorly on those fine, hardworking people who asked me to do this. It's been a real honor. I mean, I look forward to the podcast. I love recording the episodes and I don't get paid for it. It's not like I'm minting money being the podcast host.
We're familiar with that idea.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you know how the free work model works. You guys should sue yourselves for wage and hour claims, but it's a lot of fun. And it's a service I get to do to the bar. I don't have to run for election. I don't have to do any of the politicking. I can just do this. And it's a ton of fun. So the actual podcast that we know of today started in June of 2018. And in case you're wondering how I know that, I looked it up before we had this discussion because I had a feeling that might come up. And I was like, how long have we been doing this? And it's crazy that we're now at 4 years. Before that, the podcast was I'm doing air quotes for those who can't see me. It's air quotes around podcast. The State Bar annual meeting, we would have a little YouTube. It was Texas Bar TV. And Todd, you've been on that before. You've come out and been part of Texas Bar TV. And so I would sit there and I got to be a cheesy game show host. It was awesome. I'd be like, this is Rocky Deer with the State Bar of Texas, you know, Texas Bar TV, welcome. And we would get people that were at the annual meeting and we would do interviews, whether they just spoken. Sometimes it was just a man or woman on the street who was walking by and we would talk to them about who they are and what they're doing at the annual meeting, what they found interesting. But they eventually turned that into this podcast. And that launched in June of 2018. And it's great because we still get to put content out, but people don't actually have to see me. They can just listen. So it's a little bit of relief for the listener. They're like, oh, no faces involved. Yay. So that's how it started.
Have you done any episodes as Bill Clinton or Kermit yet? Or is that a future project?
It's been a number of episodes now. I think I did some impersonations on one of them. I think one of the guests who knew that I do it was like, I'm going to call you out, man. You got to do one. I think I did. I have to go back and see which one that was.
Any particularly memorable or favorite interviews?
There was this one. The guest was, he's this total nerd. It was about automated certificates of service. His name was Todd. He was an appellate lawyer. It was Todd Smith, guys.
Oh, jeez.
That was October.
He gets real excited about that topic. He's the only one in the state of Texas, but he does get very excited about it.
And you know what? All kidding aside, he actually made it interesting. When I first saw this, I was like, certificates of service. Who in the world is going to listen to this? But when we talked about it, I was like, okay, like I get it. And it was actually, I learn a lot doing the podcast because I learn about stuff that I otherwise would have never thought about. Case in point, we did one, I guess about a year ago. It was on the new ethics rules in Texas. And so we did the podcast. They asked me to actually host one of the webinars that was going to be live cast through Texas Bar CLE. And I would have looked them up at some point, but this made me really study the rules and I got to learn a lot about them. So the podcast gives me a chance to really, with the work that I do at Atlas, I'm not a practicing lawyer. I mean, we're working on our briefs. I don't get a chance to really get into the weeds of being a practicing lawyer. And the podcast gives me a chance to kind of dive into that. But Jody, to your question about memorable episodes, I mean, I don't know that I would say that there's favorites, but there are some that just stick out. Like when I'm thinking back to episodes that, and it's not necessarily because of, this is not a commentary on the guests themselves. This is more about, it's either the topic or something funny that happened or something, just a rapport that was built. But our very, very first episode was with a gentleman named Anthony Graves. And I think to date, that might be the most riveting episode we've had. We came out the gate really strong. Anthony was falsely convicted and was put on death row for a murder he did not commit. And it was a long, arduous road to kind of get him exonerated, but that happened. And so we thought, what better way to celebrate the launch of our podcast than to talk about a situation where, I don't know if you could say justice worked, but justice worked eventually. You know, it's conditional. Yeah. And we also had Brian Garner in those early episodes. Mm. And that was a trip. We interviewed him at his house, which was, that was a lot of fun. He's got the most amazing library I've ever seen. He has a building in his house called the Scriptorium. It's where he does a lot of his dictionary work. One of the really fun ones was, you guys might remember from 2020, the whole cat lawyer incident that happened with a lawyer named Rod Ponton out in West Texas.
We know it well. Rod,
yes, all Texas lawyer, all over the country, people were talking about the cat lawyer. We had Rod Ponton and Judge Roy Ferguson. Judge Ferguson was the judge in that particular episode. And Rod's famous words were, "I'm not a cat." But we had a chance to kind of not only talk about the humor in it, but we also had a chance to talk about their roles as members of that hearing, members of that situation. And if you've never had a chance to sit down with Judge Roy Ferguson, he's an extremely thoughtful individual. And he's thought deeply about all of these issues. I don't think there's anything he's thought, like, I bet even when it comes to what brand of milk he's going to buy, I think he's really thoughtful, right? And I say that, I'm roasting him a little bit, but I say that with absolute respect. In fact, Judge Ferguson was part of another episode we had on the podcast. This was at the 2019 State Bar of Texas annual meeting. And he was going to come talk about some topic that he was on a panel for. I don't remember that one as well. But after he was done, this was, mics were off, headsets were off. I said, "So Judge, now that you're on Austin, you're normally from West Texas, are you still Judge Ferguson or do you get to be Roy?" And he started talking about why he prefers to be called Judge Ferguson. And it wasn't the reason most people would think of. Being out in West Texas, it's geographically very large, but in terms of population, it's sparsely populated. He said, "If anybody calls me Roy, even my closest friends, people figure the fix is in, that I've got favorites." Mm-hmm. And so he said, even out here in Austin, he said, being in Austin, I was dinner the other night sitting at the bar and a guy down the bar recognized me from a case that I had tried with somebody that he was related to. So he said, even here, I have to make sure that I'm the judge and everybody treats me with that same level of dissociation. So he said, even friends of mine who come to my house for a barbecue, they call me Judge Ferguson. And he said, there's a reason. But and he started talking about this. And for the first time ever, I said this to a judge. I was like, "Stop talking." And we put the headphones on him. We got a microphone and we said, "Okay, now we're going to," and we turned it into a podcast episode. And it was fascinating.
Oh, that's great.
It was so organic.
Well, we're about to head to the annual meeting next week. Are you going to be bringing your microphone?
Oh, I'm there. So yes, we're going to be doing, in fact, the dance card is filled, right? I mean, it's back-to-back podcast episodes, 20 to 30 minutes each. They're not going to be the normal lengthier ones, not like this one, you know, where we're really getting into the details. These are going to be 20 to 30 minute episodes, just pop, 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 but it's filled up all day Thursday. And I think until like 2:30 on Friday. So it is back to back. We've got a lot of folks to talk to. So I need to bring some Ricolas and a lot of water, and yeah, some hot tea, but I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun. And the part that I think I will miss is being able to do the spontaneous ones, because now it's all scheduled out. Being able to just pick somebody who comes and says, "What's this?" And we tell them there's a podcast. They tell us about their story. And then we put them in front of a microphone and we just start hearing their story. And yeah, what the annual meeting has taught me is that we have a lot of very fascinating people in this state. And luckily, a lot of them happen to be lawyers. And so hearing their stories, it's always a highlight. I love it.
We look forward to hearing those episodes when they come out.
Yeah, definitely.
It'd be great for any insomnia you might suffer in the future. So, yeah.
That's what we tell people about our podcast, too.
That's right.
We're kind of getting to the end of our episode, too. And it's always our tradition to end with a tip or a war story. I don't know if you've got one or the other that you'd like to share here in the last couple of minutes.
Well, let's see. War story, I'll tell you that this isn't so much me, but this is one of my coworkers, one of my colleagues here at Atlas. He was writing an appellate brief in Ohio. This was going to the intermediate court in Ohio. And it was on an issue that he knew well because he'd briefed it before. And when he's looking up case law, he happened to find a case that he had worked on. He wrote the winning brief, and the justices had actually largely used his analysis in the brief. So he effectively cited himself, but he wasn't on Lexis or on Westlaw as the attorney of record because we were effectively writing in the background. He was kind of like Ben Affleck in Argo. The Canadians got all the credit, but he actually did all the work. And so he was just sitting there. He's like, oh, this is so cool. But at the end of it, he was like, nobody's ever going to know. And I was like, well, what do you say? Argo, cite yourself. I mean, that's what he did. And, but you know, it was fun. In terms of a very quick tip, what I'd tell lawyers and especially appellate practitioners is don't be afraid to get help. I think a lot of times as lawyers, trial lawyers and appellate lawyers, there's a tendency for all of us to be control freaks. We want to have our hands on everything. And sometimes what you really want to do to really expand your practices, get that work-life balance you want, because law is tough, and it's tough because it never leaves you. 3 a.m, you'll wake up and realize, oh, there's a case law search I need to do, or there's a part of the record I neglected to look at. And the next thing you know, you're up at 3:30 a.m. looking at this. But one of the ways to kind of mitigate that is to find people you trust, whose work product you can rely on, and give it to them, offload it on them. And then, of course, review it, read it, make it your own. But it's okay if their writing style is a little different from yours. It's okay if they use semicolons instead of full stop sentences. You have to kind of prioritize what's important and what isn't. But once you find that, I think you're going to find that your life becomes easier and you can actually get more accomplished, not just in your practice, but in the other things that matter too. So you asked me for one or the other and I gave you both. So I apologize.
That's okay. That's great.
We'll take it.
Over delivery. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been great.
No, thank you guys. This was a lot of fun. I'm not used to being the guest. This was a lot. You guys made it easy. Thank you.
Happy to do it, Rocky. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.